Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 30th day of January. It's All Things Political, which you always hear Mondays at 9 here on the Ideas Network. And our guest this hour is Joseph Williams. Joe is a veteran political journalist, and he is the White House correspondent for Politico, where he covers the Obama administration cabinet, domestic policies, as well as looking at the intersection of race and politics. He worked as deputy chief of the Boston Globe's Washington Bureau, covering the 2008 presidential campaign and 2009 inauguration. And he also was the assistant managing editor for the Star Tribune in Minneapolis, city editor for the Globe in Boston, and assistant city editor for the Miami Herald in Broward County. He's published in magazines including Essence and the Sunday Globe, and he's a former college football player, 1984 graduate of the University of Richmond, studied at Harvard as a Nieman Fellow. We'll be welcoming phone calls. We have a lot to talk about. We will probably start with the president, who's receiving slightly better numbers on how he's handling the economy. What will it take to rally the people who voted for him in 2008? One of the questions. Of course, the Florida primary is tomorrow. Mitt Romney seems to be doing better in Florida than he did in South Carolina. Much, much better. We'll find out tomorrow. But polls would indicate that is the case. What's happened to Newt Gingrich in the state of Florida? Jan Brewer, the governor of Arizona, has created quite a stir for pointing her finger at the president at the tarmac of the airport as he was visiting Arizona. So we will discuss that and a little bit more about civility in politics. And we welcome your phone calls, as we always do. Here's the phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Joe Williams, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, nice to be here.
I thought it was interesting that you played football in college, and I've often thought that there's a connection between sports and politics, I think, and the transition seems natural to me.
Well, it is in that it's some ways kind of a blood sport, and it requires a lot of mental discipline and physical stamina. That being said, I mean, my football experience wasn't the best ever. We were a horrible losing team, and we didn't ruin very much. But I still find that a lot of that mental training carries over. So I'm happy to have that at my Rolodex.
Yeah, I'll bet you are. Well, let's start with the president. His numbers seem to be a little bit better on how he's handling the economy. He gave a State of the Union address that was applauded by many, many people, including many independents in this country. He's around the country giving speeches. Is he making a mark in being able to rally the troops who voted for him in 2008?
I think he is, and I think part of that is coming out of the State of the Union address. I mean, we talk about this is probably a perfect analogy for you, football as a metaphor for politics, in that in the State of the Union, the president basically flexing. He's saying, I'm not going to back down. I'm going to take my game to the Republicans. I'm going to force them to play on my field and on my terms. And that's a big transition from the first couple of years of his administration, where he was trying to reach consensus. He was trying to find a way that he could work with Republicans. The State of the Union speech marked a very clear demarcation. To my eyes, the extension of what happened after the payroll tax fight. Not the payroll tax fight, but the debt ceiling fight in the summer, late fall of last year, where the government was basically bollocked up and the president had to go on the offensive here. So he talked very much about he was going to take take up the mantle of the populist, say that I'm fighting for the people, and anybody who stands in the way of that is going to have to deal with me. And that's something that progressives like a lot. That's something that America wants to see in their leaders. They want to see a president who is willing to stand up and fight. And I think that contributes almost as much as the positive numbers, positive economic numbers do to his upsurge.
Why was he so keen on consensus, Joe?
Well, in some ways, I think it's because he really believed it. When he was campaigning in 2008, you heard a lot about, I am the guy to change Washington politics. I'm the person who can build consensus. I've worked with Republicans in my career in the state Senate in Wisconsin, and I've worked with Democrats as well as a member of that party. And remember, back in 2004, his seminal moment in Boston was the speech where he declared there's not a red America or a blue America, there's just the United States of America. So that had been his calling card all the way to the White House. When he gets to the White House, there was the rough and tumble. They played for keeps, and I think the president was caught a bit flat-footed by that, and he wanted to try to maintain the Obama brand, if you will, talking about consensus, reaching cross-party lines, and he just simply was not able to do that.
His State of the Union address, from all indications, was very popular among the American people, independents, Democrats, and even some Republicans. What chord did he strike that was so universally admired?
The chord that he struck, in my opinion, is twofold. The first is, I'm going to fight. I spent the first 3 years of my administration trying to reach consensus and bridge the gap. That time is done. That is something that a lot of people around the country outside of the Beltway have been throwing up their hands. Moderates, independents have been saying, look, why isn't this guy fighting? The Republicans are rolling him at every opportunity. This is the perception that's being discussed outside the Beltway. He needs to take the gloves off. So that's, I think, one element where he said, you can call it class warfare if you want, but I plan to fight for the middle class against the rich. The second is that very much he repeated time and again the theme that he's going to be running on. I'm fighting for the middle class. I'm fighting for equality. The rich have gotten richer at the expense of the rest of us. That is a chord that people wanted to hear across the political spectrum, not necessarily so much on the right, but certainly to the center left. They want to see equity come back in, and it also points to how Occupy Wall Street has injected that sort of sentiment into the national conversation.
Do you think, Joe, that you would see a change in his economic team in a second administration?
I think you will, and I think that's not necessarily by design. Typically, a transition point, either halfway through the first term or going into the second term, you will find a lot of people saying, you know what, I've done my time in public service, I'm going to drop out. And I think if the president is serious about this economic message, about tacking more towards the left than to the center, you will see more faces, more new faces coming in, more faces that will have that kind of mindset going into advisory meetings with the president and with the rest of his staff.
Mm-hmm. And when you listen to the State of the Union, what progressive notes did he strike?
Oh, several. He was talking about energy independence, again, the theme about wealth inequality. He kind of alluded to Occupy Wall Street but didn't take it head on. The progressives have long wanted him to put up his dukes, and fight and take it to the Republicans rather than have the Republicans dictate what the president can and cannot do. That was a very, very popular theme there. He got a big thumbs up from the center to the far left on that. He also talked about energy independence, doubling down to a degree on clean energy. He also talked about making college affordable and committing more resources towards higher education and trying to bring down the costs so that everyone can get ahead. And again, that was the overarching theme, was that the chance that children can do better than their parents has been lost over the last 10 or 15 years. We need to get it back. Need to start now, because this is a defining moment for the middle class. And I think that was the biggest kind of resonance that he had on the left and even towards the center to a degree.
I'm trying to get a handle on how important this issue of wealth inequality is. You hear and you read differing things that some people are saying it's absolutely terrible. The gap is wider than it's been for 100 years, and people are struggling. And then on the other hand, you'll read, well, we don't begrudge the rich their riches, and we don't necessarily want them to have less because we want to be where they are. Where is the truth in all of it?
Well, as usual in most situations and arguments, the truth is somewhere in between. On the one hand, you do have wages that have stagnated over the past 30 years. They've basically been flat, not kept pace with inflation. And many people, even people in the upper income levels, it's almost impossible to have a one-income household anymore. And that really speaks volumes to where people live. You don't necessarily have to be on the bottom third of the wealth ladder to have experienced that. Secondarily, not only have wages remained stagnant, prices have gone up, and you can't anticipate getting a cost of living increase anymore. Manufacturing jobs have disappeared. no more opportunity for high school grads or even community college grads to earn a decent living with their hands. So on the one hand, the evidence is very strong that the wealth gap has increased and that that is probably where a large percentage of this argument comes from. On the other hand, the 1% has acute vast wealth that we can't even begin to imagine. I mean, one of the arguments that the president is going to make should Mitt Romney become the nominee is that he is the poster child for the 1%. You've got a guy who's talking about how he's been able to make money with money and not have a real wage job for years. So they are talking about the fact that people like Mitt Romney are in opportunities to create jobs. They just haven't done so to the degree that people would want and that would help benefit the vast stretches of the middle and the lower thirds of the income level.
Joe, do you think Romney will be the nominee?
It's looking more and more. I mean, the smart money in Washington says yes. But the caveat behind that is anything can happen. Long, long months between now and the Republican convention, you had a Romney look like he was going to go 3-0 heading into South Carolina, and it turns out that he was 1-2. And he managed to gain ground in Florida, and it looks like he's going to take the state, which would be basically a turbo boost towards the nomination in Florida in the summertime.
And what's been going on in Florida? Why is Newt Gingrich falling from graces?
Lots of money. And Romney has it, and Gingrich doesn't. He's being outspent 4-1 in Florida.
Wow.
It's been about $14 million that Romney has spent on the airwaves and on the ground in Florida compared to Gingrich's $4.5 million, give or take. So that advantage is almost impossible to overcome in politics. And it's not been so much that people have been surging towards Mitt Romney so much as they've been moving away from Newt Gingrich. The ads really have taken their toll, and it's been stark that from the beginning of this segment of the primary anyway, that Gingrich does not have the money and the organization over the long haul. He's been dependent on one or two fairly wealthy benefactors to stay in the race, and that's the only thing that's been keeping him afloat so far.
Mm-hmm. The New York Times asked the question yesterday, and I wonder what you thought about this, because we do read a lot about all of his marriages. Newt Gingrich will go down in history as the politician who conclusively proved that voters don't care about a candidate's sexual misbehavior. Do you think that's true?
I think it's true right now. It's one of those facts that history has disproven over the course of several years. I mean, remember, Gary Hart went down because of marital infidelity. So did a couple of people in Congress who's I'm blanking on the names right now, but there have been congressional scandals where it has not involved performance on the job. It's involved sexual misbehavior. On the other hand, you have David Vitter, who's still serving in Congress, and that sort of disproves the rule. You had John Ensign, who was there for quite some time after allegations about his infidelity hit the papers. And I think it's true in this moment because the Republicans are so focused and so excised about getting President Obama out of the White House. Gingrich is gaining favor despite all his baggage because he is the two-fisted guy. He is the guy who is vowing to bloody the president. He has proven that he could bloody Mitt Romney and has proven that he can command a cheering audience from the debate stage. If that's enough over the long haul remains to be seen, and it's really hard to imagine how that is the only thing that's going to manage to defeat President Obama. There are a lot of other variables there that Gingrich has issues with.
We go to phone calls. We have a couple lines open at the moment if you'd like to join the conversation. It's All Things Political for this Monday, and our guest is Joseph Williams. He is the White House correspondent for Politico. He covers the Obama administration cabinet and domestic politics. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program today, in his State of the Union address, the president called for community colleges and businesses to form partnerships to train students with skills that employers in their area really need, programs that community colleges have in place, many of them, and We will talk about community colleges, technical colleges. Milwaukee has a very, Wisconsin has a very extensive system of technical schools. We'll have two guests with us, the Executive Assistant and Vice President of Policy and Government Relations for the Wisconsin Technical College System and the Director of National Research Center for Career and Technical Education at the University of Louisville. So that's coming up, hour number two. To your phone calls now for all things political, Joe Williams, our guest, and we start with Jim in Milwaukee. Hello, Jim.
Yeah, hi. It seems to me Romney's doing better now against Gingrich because he knows that the truth works if you get it out, which is something that the Democrats should do more of on regards to the Republicans. But it's interesting also that Romney's selective in the process because he focuses on Gingrich's ethical deficiencies in Congress, but he doesn't talk about the appeal to racism, and he doesn't talk about the liberal media con because this would out the Republicans for the game that they've been playing very successfully since LBJ's Voting Rights Act. And, of course, these guys are involved in false piety. Scott Walker talks about God telling him things to do, and Gingrich, how he made peace with God, but they ignore the Beatitudes and other things that might come from God that they don't want to talk about. And then Wednesday's Milwaukee Journal perspective page, Leonard Pitts came out, and he said that he was talking about racism, and he said one of his students shared this parable. A rich white man sits at the table with a poor white man and a poor black man at a table laden with cookies, and the rich white man snatches all the cookies but one, and then turns to the poor white man and says, "Watch out for that darkie. I think he wants to take your cookie." It works every time. So they know how to play the game. They will claim that the Democrats are talking about envy, but they don't have any problem with practicing the politics of racial resentment and mass distraction. So, they're very selective in the kind of ethics that they want to talk about, and they don't want us to know how they kind of manipulate us.
Jill.
Well, it's been a very consistent theme over the last, say, 20, 25 years worth of elections on the right, is that the Southern strategy works, and the appeals to us versus them, it carries a lot of weight. And I'm reminded of LBJ's remark after he signed the Civil Rights Act in 1964, saying that, well, there goes the South for the next, 20, 30 years, and he was absolutely right, that kind of appeal and that zero-sum game manipulation of the argument, it works. And the Republicans know how to play that, and in some ways it's been very, very coded, and you have to understand that code in order to be receptive to it. That being said, I think that people understand fundamentally that the elections are about winning arguments, and it's about which argument you think will carry the day, and people want someone, and they don't care almost in some degrees how it happens, but they want someone who can defeat Barack Obama, regardless of where they're coming from and what they have to do that. They're very incensed about that.
Why is it that Newt Gingrich would call Obama the food stamp president when all indications are that a lot of people needed to be on food stamps because we were verging on a depression here? Is there an element of race in that comment? Why does he keep saying that?
Well, because it works. that's the short answer. And there is some element of otherness there. And that's one of the things they keep pointing to when they talk about President Obama. One argument I had with a friend of mine the other night, a Democrat strategist, was saying that the Republicans are very focused on getting rid of this guy, and it's very easy to make these kinds of appeals because Americans like consistency. They like things that are the same. Starbucks, Target, McDonald's. Consistency is very important in the American psyche. So now you have a president who doesn't look like any of the other presidents. And because of that, he doesn't look like them, he doesn't have the same history. Because of that, it's very easy to make these appeals that he is not like us, and he has a different agenda. And people who don't agree with what he is saying, they're very receptive to that message, and it helps them justify why they want to feel this way. It helps them justify why they have this notion that because he's not like one of us, we should vote against him.
Jim, thanks for your call. Sam in Madison. Hi, Sam.
Good morning, Kathleen. Good morning, dear guest. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have a comment in general on Barack Obama's presidency and his re-election. I supported Barack Obama wholeheartedly in 2008. I even campaigned for him. However, I feel completely betrayed by him. I think that he had a couple of years to when he had full majority in Senate of the House, he could have got a lot done, but he did not. He said that he was going to change the ways of the Washington, but I think he is the one who got changed, and he has changed. He has raised more money than any other president, and most of his donations are from big corporations, which is exactly what he promises to fight with. But having said that, you know, even though I have such a big problem with him, he is 100 times better than Mitt Romney, Newt Gingrich, Rick Santorum. Ron Paul, he's not 100 times better. I think he's twice only as good as Ron Paul. But, I mean, I like Ron Paul. But so, which is unfortunate, I mean, because even though I disagree with Barack Obama, I'm still going to support him because the Republican Party has come out with some absolutely horrendous candidates. And I don't know what that says about the American political system where, you know, you're kind of stuck in a situation where you have to vote for the candidate who you like the least as opposed to one who you like the most.
You campaigned for him last go-around. Will you campaign for him this go-around, Sam?
Say it again, Kevin.
Will you campaign for Obama this year?
That's a good question. I think I would not campaign for him this year. I would support him, but I would not distribute that image of hope like I did in 2008 this year.
All right. Thank you, Sam. Joe?
Well, Sam represents a lot of what some people on the left are feeling, that they felt like they've gotten more or less sold a bill of goods by the guy who was out there preaching hope and change and could rally 200,000 or 20,000 people at the drop of a hat, versus the guy who got into office, got bogged down with a lot of policy discussions, was unable to turn the political ship, if you will, to any great degree of certainty despite having majorities in the House and the Senate. That's something the White House is quite concerned about. That's also something that those of us who kind of study these things picked up on a few things in the State of the Union, where he was making that appeal, trying to reach back out to those voters who are disillusioned, reach back out to people like Sam, saying, look, stay with us. The fight is not over yet. We are now tacking more toward in your direction because we know what we did wrong the first couple of years. One of the things that I would point out is that even though the president had supermajorities in the House and the Senate, part of the problem was the Senate because a lot of the conservative Democrats, Blanche Lincoln, Mark Pryor, Mary Landrieu, some of the Southern Democrats who were in there, they were ones who moved the agenda further to the right. Now, that being said, the president probably could have done a lot more arm twisting and a lot more influence, exerted a lot more of his influence to get them in his direction. But that was one of the reasons why he was unable to get a lot of stuff done in the first term. That and the fact that he was still trying to reach this bipartisan nirvana that doesn't seem to exist in Washington anymore.
Ellen in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hello. First of all, I don't think we're, you know, all so greedy that we want to be multi-millionaires or billionaires. I think we just want to have a nice life. I certainly don't want to be responsible for that kind of money. And my second thing is, you know, I'm so sick of the Republicans with their divide and conquer. They're just, we have to be able to fight, you know, to turn that around, that idea, those, they always call them Reagan Democrats. That's the most absurd message I've ever heard. But I suppose it's true because that's when we started pitting one group of people against the other. And it all started with civil rights and affirmative action, and it's just got, that story has to be turned around somehow.
Joe?
That's the message that the White House is trying to deliver this election cycle. And it's not so much that everyone wants to be part of the 1%, but certainly everyone wants to live comfortably. And the ability to live comfortably has eroded significantly over the last two decades. A lot of factors for that, manufacturing moving overseas, wage stagnation, as I mentioned earlier, the decline of education to a degree, in that it takes more of it to get a decent job. But what the White House wants to do in this particular election is tap into that restlessness, that sort of angst, and reverse it and use it to their advantage. And I think the one thing you'll find, the White House is very, very good at campaign mode. The governing thing took a little while for them to get, you know, to get the hang of, but campaign mode, they're all about it. So I think you'll see a lot of messaging targeted to people like Ellen. I think you'll see a lot of discussion about the Republican divide and conquer tactics, and there'll be some pushback. I mean, it's not going to be an easy election like it was in 2008. It'll be significant. It'll be a lot of fisticuffs going on. Seem to be sticking to the fighting analogy quite a bit today, but there's going to be a lot of dusting up. So stay tuned and listen very carefully for what they've got to say.
Thanks, Ellen, for your call. Bill in Madison, hi.
Yeah, I don't even know where to start. I voted for Obama in 2008 enthusiastically, though I have to admit that in 2008, I saw in the Republican candidate, John McCain, a person whom I disagreed with on every issue, but I saw as an honorable, decent human being. I don't see anyone like that in the Republican field. None of them were even decent human beings, let alone decent candidates for president. But Obama has really disappointed me because here it is, the election year of his first term. I mean, after he's coming to the end of his first term, and he's finally figured out that he's not going to be able to reach this consensus. You know, he's finally decided to take the gloves off, and he's squandered so many opportunities. He's mishandled, misgoverned. He ran as a center left candidate, and he governed as a center right president in order to win Republican consensus, and he got absolutely no political capital for it. And I'm going to hold my nose and vote for him in 2012 only because the Republicans, no matter who, are so bad that, you know, that, I mean, they could put Humpty Dumpty in the Democratic ticket, and I'd still vote for him to keep one of those Republicans out.
Joe.
Tell us how you really feel, Bill. But I think that what Bill is talking about is a lot of the frustration that people feel in not having a very clear, distinct choice on the Democratic side that will fulfill everything that they want, and having a Republican option to choose from in case the Democrat thing doesn't work out. Part of the problem, as we see it inside here in Washington, is that the Republican Party has shifted so far to the right that moderation almost doesn't exist. You don't have a Rockefeller Republican. You don't even have a Nixon Republican talk about a human being that some people have a lot of qualms with. At the very least, if you look strictly at policy issues, Richard Nixon was a moderate Republican. He voted for some clean energy initiatives, universal health care was on his agenda, and he tried to normalize relationships with China. So very much so, that sort of Republican is extinct anymore, and I think that's what's causing a lot of the frustration, because either you have to vote for someone that a lot of the left sees as a center-left at the very most Democrat, and a center-right Republican, you know, Republican-like brand being put on the president, or you've got to go to the extreme right. And that sort of gradation is really missing in politics today, and it's quite unfortunate. And hopefully there'll be a renaissance sometime soon where we can have people like that, that folks like Bill, I beg your pardon, could get behind. But one other quick point. A lot of people said the same thing about Bill Clinton in 99, or his last term in 96, when he was up for re-election. We're going to hold our nose and vote for him. Now he's widely regarded as one of the better presidents in American history. So hindsight tends to be a lot kinder to presidents in this instance than the current day does.
What is the Republicans, because you know darn well that both parties have strategies for winning this election, considering the fact that their candidates are more conservative than they have been in the past, what is their strategy for winning the presidency? Is it an indication that the country itself has moved farther to the right?
Well, it is. And I think their one overarching strategy, it can be summed up in a phrase from Bill Clinton. It's the economy, stupid. You know, this president has been given 4 years to try to turn things around. He has not. Now, a lot of that has been to Republican obstruction and Democratic
I'm struggling for the right word. Democratic in not ineptitude is not the right word, but certainly ineffectiveness is probably a better one. So both parties share some of the blame for the fact that the economy has been in the dumper, but certainly you had a president who brought things back from the brink. Things probably could have been a lot worse than they are. That's a really difficult argument to make on the campaign trail. It's difficult to disprove or point to an accident that didn't happen as opposed to looking at one that actually did. I mean, we're still standing on the ashes of a really bad economic situation, and it's not come close to being cleaned up to its to its former condition. So that's going to be their big strategy. But also the fact that social issues are not taking hold as much as they used to because the economy is the overarching theme. So people are willing to overlook things like Rick Santorum's message on abortion or on morality. They're willing to overlook Newt Gingrich's baggage, steamer trunks, if you will. They're willing to overlook that because the economy is the central message. If you have a message that speaks to that, or conversely, if you have a message that says, we're going to get rid of the guy who's in there now, then you have a strong chance of winning the argument with the American people.
Thanks, Bill, for the call. We go to Rich and Sullivan. Hi, Rich.
Hi. I wanted to ask your guest whether or not my thinking is really foggy on this. I think this election coming up is going to be a vote on the Supreme Court decision, Citizens United, that is, money is speech, because I perceive a movement growing in the country where we're going to have to decide who's more like us. A black man who came from what was essentially a single mother raising him, who worked hard and struggled and ultimately became chief executive of the major power in the world, or one of the major powers in the world, or a man who was born into wealth and is willing to spend money hand over fist currently in Florida in order to beat someone whom I consider to be a fairly silly little man, Newt Gingrich. I'm sorry if I offend people by saying that, but I really don't see him as a serious candidate. And I have faith in the American people that they're going to look at this likely opposition between a Mitt Romney ticket and a Barack Obama ticket, and they're going to say, you know, especially among young people, I think they're going to say, you know who's really more like us? It's not the white guy. It's the black guy.
Joe.
Well, that's a very important point that a lot of strategists have said the election, and one of the reasons why Romney has struggled so much, is he doesn't get a positive response when voters are asked the question, who cares about people like me? Who looks out for my interests? Who can I relate to? Who relates to things that are going on in my life? Romney he grew up the scion of a General Motors executive up in Michigan, very comfortable existence, didn't necessarily have to start out from scratch like Obama did and have a mother who was leaning on public assistance just to get by. So that's one aspect that is a big Achilles heel for Romney and a net positive for Obama, even though the majority of the country still doesn't look like the president. It's still a majority white country for the most part. And that's something that he had to overcome in 2008, and now people are willing to look past that. The second point about Citizens United, that's becoming so clear this cycle, especially on the Republican side, where you have Newt Gingrich, a candidate who was left for dead, literally, almost literally left for dead, his candidacy, that is, in the early parts of the election cycle in the spring and summer of 2011. He was gallivanting off to Greece. He was revealed he had a $500,000 credit line at Tiffany's. He wasn't campaigning in Iowa. Then all of a sudden, things become personal between him and Mitt Romney, and you have a backer, Sheldon Adelson, taking advantage of the Citizens United rule, pouring unlimited amounts of money, $10 million by the account so far, into Gingrich's campaign, almost single-handedly keeping him afloat. Then you have the Koch brothers in your state of Wisconsin being connected with the governor there, and all those revelations and those connections are being revealed, and it's being traced back to Citizens United. So I think there is going to be a popular uprising against this kind of unlimited money campaigns because it takes the decision almost entirely out of the hands of the people. They still get to cast a vote, but who they get to vote for is largely decided in back rooms, in meetings, in private jets, in those sorts of things, and I don't think the people will stand for that very much longer.
Well, consider this for a minute. I was absolutely amazed. I'm getting up there in years, and I was amazed by the last election. I've never seen anything like it in my lifetime. The enthusiasm, you can't understate what happened in this country, how historic it was, how moving it was. With what we've just been talking about, Citizens United, add the fact that people are unhappy, many of them, with the president's performance. They're very unhappy about the Republicans' choices. It's going to be harder to vote in a lot of states with voter IDs and making it difficult for people to get to the polls. I just wonder about the enthusiasm here, Joe. Do you think that we could see an election where a lot of people are just going to stay home?
That is something, add that one to the list of the White House's worries, because you do have an electorate on the right that is very enthusiastic about turning out to turn against this particular president. While on the left, you have a lot of people like your two previous callers, Bill and I'm forgetting the one gentleman's name.
Sam.
Who are just kind of throwing up their hands saying, look, this isn't the guy I voted for. So the flip side of the Citizens United coin is that the Democrats, in order to counter that enthusiasm gap, get to spend their money to try to get people amped up again. And you're going to see that in ads. You're going to see it in get out the vote, in rallies. Plus, you have the power of the incumbent, of the president, who's going to try to recapture the lightning in a bottle that he had in 2008. It's going to be a difficult sell. If he can regenerate that enthusiasm, despite a record that some people are very middle of the road about, and despite some headwinds, you could see that enthusiasm regain. And I would almost single-handedly attribute it to the fact that Occupy Wall Street has occupied so much of the nation's consciousness. And if I may make one more point,
of course,
the flip side of the enthusiasm gap that you're speaking of was seen in Wisconsin in January, where you had a lot of people getting out because it was something that they felt passionate about. They felt that the issues were being taken out of their hands, and they turned out in great. We had seen nothing like it. I haven't in the years that I've been covering politics, where you had this kind of a groundswell. A lot of cynical types on the right will say, well, a lot of corporate money was behind that too. But what I saw from a distance, mind you, was people. I saw people out on the streets. I saw people motivated to do something and take a stand. And I think that this could happen in the election. And it might not happen behind a candidate, but it certainly may happen in the desire to take back the political system, in the desire to participate, in the desire to stand for the 99 or stand against what a lot of people are starting to see as inequity in not only the political system, but also in the economic system, which is right where people live.
Joe Williams, our guest for All Things Political, and we're welcoming more phone calls. There's one line open, 800-486-8655. He is the White House correspondent for Politico, where he covers the Obama administration, cabinet, and domestic policies. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Technical colleges, community centers, preparing students for jobs with skills that are needed by employers. That's the second hour of the program. Adam in Cashton. Hi, Adam.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a first-time caller. This is my first time ever calling, and nothing's ever got me so inspired to call public radio as this.
Thanks, Adam.
I really think that Ron Paul deserves a lot more media coverage. I'm not a political person at all. I'm just a normal farmer, vegetable farmer. He is the only candidate that stands for any change. He's the only candidate that's not bought. He's supported by everyday Joes like you and me that give him $100. And, you know, all the other candidates, they represent big business and big corporations, and they're supported by Freddie Mac and, you know, Bain and it just doesn't make sense to me that he's not given more media coverage, because more people would get excited about him like I do.
And what excites you about him? What are the policies that grab your attention?
The main ones, Kathleen, are that he wants to get us out of the wars overseas. I mean, just that alone, no other candidate is talking about bringing the troops home and quitting the wars. I mean, I look at it more as the human race has just got to quit warring. I mean, we have troops all over the all over the world, and we should bring them home, and that's directly tied to the deficit problem.
Thank you for calling, Adam. I'm glad to have a first-time caller. Joe.
Well, it's really cool to hear from an actual bachelor farmer. Mm-hmm. I thought they just existed on Lake Wobegon.
Vegetable farmer. But maybe he's a bachelor. I don't know.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, bachelor, that's close enough. Anyway, a couple things. Ron Paul is something of a political anomaly. I mean, the guy's been running for president for the last three, four cycles. He's got a very strong, devoted following. And he does get a fair share of media coverage. You'll recall back during the Iowa primary, there was a lot of talk about how he could actually take that race from Mitt Romney. He was surging in the polls. People were receptive to his message. Because he has this dedicated following, he's getting a lot of crowds in Iowa, people chanting, people saying that he is the future of American politics, precisely because he is for ending all wars, which is something that Democrats and liberals are very fond of. But he's also for eliminating the Federal Reserve and getting rid of government controls over business, which is something that really the Republicans give a big thumbs up to. So he is the unique politician that bridges both sides, and I think that's why he's getting a lot of why people like Adam are very enthusiastic about his message. The problem with Ron Paul, however, is that message doesn't always stand up under scrutiny. Certainly, he got his fair share of media attention in the months leading up to weeks leading up to Iowa, where it looks like his poll numbers were up there. And he wilted to a degree, especially behind these newsletters that he produced in the early years of his national political campaigns, talking about such things as you know, it had some racist overtones to them, had some really deplorable statements in there, and he was getting the kind of coverage that people like Adam were demanding, and he ended up walking out of a couple of interviews. It proved that he was a little bit prickly, mainly because the interviewers and the questioners and the press coverage wasn't entirely focused on the positives of his campaign. Like it or not, politics is a contact sport, again, to torture the sports analogy. It's a contact sport. You either can take the hits or you can't, and it looked at that instant like he wasn't able to take the hits. His numbers went down. He lost Iowa. He wasn't a factor in New Hampshire. Well, he was a semi-factor in New Hampshire, but certainly was not in South Carolina, nor is he one in Florida. Having said that, ask Adam to wait a little while, because he is going to compete very strong in the Nevada caucuses, which are coming up in a few weeks. He probably will make some noise going forward on the West Coast swing, and maybe even during Super Tuesday. So it's not over yet for Ron Paul. Certainly the media coverage isn't.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Adam, so much for your call. Pat in Wauwatosa, hi.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Pat.
Our local or diocesan Catholic newspaper had an article a few weeks ago. The headline, Catholic GOP Candidates Asked to Stop Racial Stereotypes. And it said Father Brian Massengale among the theologians making the request. Now, this group is called Faith in Public Life, and it's a group of theologians and leaders in Catholic organizations. And they're calling on particularly the two Catholic candidates, Rick Santorum and Newt Gingrich, to stop perpetuating ugly stereotypes on the campaign trail. I'll just read. They feel that some of their referring to our first African-American president with a title that invokes the past myth of welfare queens and other racist stereotypes. They say Gingrich frequently blasted Obama as a food stamp president and implied that some African-Americans are more content to collect welfare than benefits than work. And then they refer to Santorum making the remark in Iowa he doesn't want to make black people's lives better by giving them somebody else's money.
Right.
And this is signed by many, many leaders like the Sisters of Mercy of the Americas, the Leadership Conference of Women Religious, Pax Christi, and Network, a Catholic social justice lobby, and then many academics from prestigious Catholic institutions. So at least I didn't listen to the debates, but I'm glad that they are and and all the remarks they're making. Could I just say my one concern, the last caller mentioned it, out of all the, I'm sorry for all the economic woes everyone has and all the other issues, but war is what scares me the most about Republican candidates. So on that note, I'll stop.
Thank you, Pat. Thanks for your call. Joe.
Well, there are two things that occur to me right off the bat in that call, Kathleen. And the first is that race still matters. I mean, we've had roughly a half dozen calls. Maybe two or three of them mentioned the fact that there's an element of race that still lingers over this campaign, going from the 2012 campaign for the presidency. And this is after we had such a seminal moment, not only in the history of the nation, but in the history of race relations in this nation, when President Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2009. That was supposed to usher in a post-racial society. It never really happened, or it never happened to the complete degree that a lot of people wish it had. So that strikes me right off the bat in that we've got this going forward. We're going to have probably more of it during the campaign. It's not going to go away. We still have some work to get done on that question as a country. The second is the fact that a lot of the appeals from the right mentioned the phrase, and the Tea Party was very very apt for them, take our country back. Well, take it back from who? I mean, who took it? Where did it go? And what does it look like? Did we file a missing country report? And that is sort of speaks to the otherness that we're going to have to wrestle with again going forward in 2012. The third thing is war, the anti-war sentiment that's still out there. A lot of people are saying that the war should never have been started. Certainly you can argue that, and we've argued it over the last 5-6 years about Iraq, Afghanistan, and potentially Pakistan and the drone wars going on. War benefits no one, but it has to be seen as a necessity. Certainly Barack Obama said so, that he's not opposed to all wars, he's opposed to dumb wars. When you've got that, coupled with the fact that the right is talking about building up the military even more than it is now so that we have a viable threat, we have a viable pushback against any kind of international threat, signals to me that that war is not going anywhere anytime soon. And it reminds me of a couple of distant echoes from the 1960s in that you take all these three things together in a 2012 election, wow, how far have we come and how far do we have to go since the 1960s when these were hot burn front issues for everyone in the nation?
Yeah. Frank in Madison. Morning, Frank.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi.
Both you and your guest have in part dealt with this, but I would like to ask the guest if he thinks we could have an insurgent period coinciding with the run-up to the election. Because in the past, real reform, and is it clear that the establishment understands that real reform is necessary, has coincided with external insurgencies and an internal establishment class traitor, both the Roosevelts, Teddy and Franklin. And I wonder if we're going to dissipate the tensions and if there is any real recognition of the need for reform. And could Obama, who's essentially a meritocrat, he's an establishment figure, does he understand that he would have to respond to an external insurgency and really fight to bring about genuine reform? And he has half a year to position himself to do that. So if he isn't going to be Teddy or Franklin, can he be Truman? And so thank you.
Thank you, Frank, for the call, as always. Joe?
Well, that's an interesting perspective from Frank, and two things occur to me. The first is that politics and reform in politics is like the weather. Everybody talks about it, but nobody does anything about it. I mean, certainly you have a name out of a hat of a member of Congress, open that envelope, talk to them. The first thing we'll say is Washington is broken. Nobody says Washington is fine, we're doing things great. Everybody talks about reform. Real reform, I think, died with moderation in the Republican Party, because you do have a very significant swath of moderation on the left. You don't have that anymore on the right. Real reform in both Roosevelt's day, took moderates from both parties to get together and force the president, or at least give him some space, some political space, to achieve the reforms that were necessary. That era, I believe, is gone, at least for the next cycle, certainly for the foreseeable future, unless there is this groundswell by the people, unless there is a demand from the right to move the party closer to the center. I don't see that happening anytime soon.
Let's go to Jeff briefly. Jeff, you have 30 seconds.
I'll just say I'd like those who think he has done nothing, turn to a website called obamaachievements.org. It's put together by volunteers. You can see actually what he has done in the face of obstruction for several years. No, he has not been perfect. No, he has not done what I would like, but he has done a lot, and I think it's worth a re-election on. Turn to that, and you will be better informed.
Thank you very much for the call, and you have 20 seconds, Joe.
Well, the White House would say amen to that. That's been their message going forward, to try to highlight these accomplishments. You heard several of them in the president's speech, kicking off and ending with the Operation Osama bin Laden, and the fact that national security issues, which were his big bugaboo in 2008, are no longer on the picture. Still, the big problem is, many people are asking, great, Mr. President, where's my job? And that's going to be the very big difficulty that he's going to have to overcome going forward in 2012.
Yeah. Well, Joe, thank you so much. It was a great pleasure to speak with you. I hope you had a good time and you'll return.
Absolutely. The pleasure was mine. I enjoyed it quite a bit.
Great. Thanks, Joe. Joe Williams, our guest this hour. He's a veteran political journalist. He is now the White House correspondent for Politico, covering the Obama administration cabinet and domestic politics and examining the intersection of race and politics. He's also worked for the Boston Globe's Washington Bureau, where he was deputy chief, covering the 2008 presidential campaign and the inauguration. And he's worked for papers in Minneapolis, the Globe in Boston, and the Miami Herald in Broward County. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production in our downtown Milwaukee studios. More to come.